This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
559, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. In celebration of KBOO's 45th anniversary happening this year, coming up next is, instead of Out Loud Radio, is a special edition of Tune In, Turn On, and Remember.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
What we're going to do is throw a lot of banana peels around Chicago and have the machine stumble.
I had a dream that the only reason the employers were so powerful was that we were weak.
There's this myth that black people did not resist until Watts or until the Black Panther Party. It's just not true.
The Oglala Nation is at a crossroads that can change the course of history for Indian people all across the nation.
The other half of the women's liberation movement is the boys. And that man who is strong enough to be gentle, that is a new man.
The Stonewall Bar to me is a terrible place where something great happened.
For 45 years, KBOO has let the sun shine in across Cascadia's airwaves. Join us every month in this, our 45th year, as we tell another story from the history of KBOO.
Pacifica Radio is the nation's oldest network of community radio stations. It was founded in 1949 as a visionary alternative to commercially driven media, and since that time has served as a beacon for non-commercial free media. The Pacifica Network includes five sister stations in New York, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Berkeley, and Houston, along with over 150 affiliated independent radio stations throughout the United States. KBOO Radio is one of these 150 affiliates. In 1999, the Pacifica Network faced a crisis that shook it to the core and was the biggest challenge faced by that network since its founding. This hour, we'll look at that historic moment in community radio history and how it impacted KBOO Community Radio here in Portland. The crisis involved an attempt by the non-elected National Board of Pacifica Radio to take control of the signals of the main Pacifica stations and the takeover of several of the local boards of the stations by corporate interests. At the time, the Pacifica management fired staff from a number of stations and censored the coverage by award-winning journalist Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!, which eventually led to the split of Democracy Now! From the Pacifica network. The Pacifica management hired union-busting lawyers and armed security to keep staff locked out at the flagship Pacifica station, KPFA, in Berkeley, eventually costing the network hundreds of thousands of dollars. And leaked emails revealed a plan by the management to sell off the transmitter of the New York Pacifica station, WBAI, which was then valued at $250,000 on the open market. These moves outraged listeners and supporters, who organized a grassroots campaign to save Pacifica from being sold to the highest bidder. The affiliate network organized a rent strike, withholding their annual dues payments to the Pacifica National Administration until the situation was resolved. We'll look at how KBOO responded at the time and speak with some of the staff members who lost their jobs in the midst of the crisis. First, we go to a segment of Democracy Now! In 1999, in which host Amy Goodman spoke with Dennis Bernstein after he was forcibly removed from the studio at KPFA in Berkeley for talking about the crisis on the air. This program is from March of 1999, and while it aired on affiliate stations, it was censored on the main Pacifica stations.
We are going to hear what the KPFA news sounded like last night. It was about 6 o'clock, 6:10 Pacific Standard Time when their news goes on. Mark Miracle was doing the cast, the news director at KPFA, and he was running a Pacifica national piece. I believe it was on health care. You're going to hear excerpts, tiny excerpts of that piece, but it was continually turned off. We'll find out why later, and then you'll hear the room sound of what happened.
Range of American society. It's the majority of the uninsured are white, minority.
I am nervous. I'm afraid you're going to hurt me. You're going to shoot me.
African Americans.
I have the lines here. Excuse me, you cannot.
Ma'am, we interrupt the story from Mark Beavis on HMO because Dennis Bernstein of France Flashpoint has been put on administrative leave for his playing of a press conference concerning the crisis here at KPFA on Flashpoint just within the last half an hour. The KPFA, the guards that Pacifica has placed in KPFA are trying to drag him out of the studio.
The and here you are, ready to
and you can hear that in the background.
What is Pacifica coming to?
Garland Ganter, who is the general manager of the Pacifica station in Houston, was brought in by Pacific Executive Director.
And that was the end of the local newscast at KPFA in Berkeley, at which point the plug was pulled and it went to tape programming that has been running since then from the Pacifica archives.
We've been listening to a clip of a Democracy Now! Segment that aired in March of 1999 during the Pacifica radio network crisis. You're listening to a KBOO special. Tune in, turn on, and remember 45 years of KBOO history. Tonight's show is focusing on a crisis that rocked the world of community radio in 1999, when the Pacifica Radio Network faced an attempted corporate takeover, the firing of staff, and the hiring of union-busting law firms and armed security that ended up costing the network hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm joined now by Bernard White, a long-term WBAI programmer and staff member. And I wonder if you can talk about what happened at WBAI, particularly the so-called Christmas coup, where you were given a notice that you would be fired from your job and wouldn't be able to come into the station without being arrested in Christmas of 2000.
Well, it's a complicated story. I'll see if I can condense it and still have it make sense. There was in 2000, Christmas of 2000, or was it 1999? Anyway, what happened was that there was a takeover of the national board by people who had a totally different philosophy than what had gone on at Pacifica prior to that time. They were more corporate types and more corporate thinking. And they saw not that the information was paramount, but that there was an opportunity there, they felt, to begin to raise a lot of money. There were some folks who believed that they could flip radio stations. For instance, that they could take WBAI and sell it and get a lot of money for it. At that time, I think they were talking about between $250 and $300 million, that they could take that money and buy several radio stations in the South. We were moved to Wall Street by Pacifica, basically, and told that, the reason why we had moved to Wall Street is because they were going to make the Wall Street address the primary address for the Pacifica Foundation, and they were going to operate out of there. After selling WBAI, they were going to open up a smaller radio station. One of the reasons why I was fired and my assistant, Sharan, was also fired, is because that we would have been a vocal opposition to that and would have been able to organize the staff and listeners, they felt, to oppose what it is that they were going to do. So,
well, let's step back.
At that time, we were both fired. Sharan Harper is the one I'm talking about. And I was told that I could not enter the building. If I did, I would be arrested and that no one could have me on the air to speak out about anything. A gag rule was put on all of the producers, and those who did speak out were severely disciplined. Many of them lost their programs at that particular time. And we organized a Pacifica campaign to try and tell people what was going on at Pacifica and help to organize the listeners into an effort to take it back. And I think we were out for about 13 months, and we were finally successful in forcing Pacifica, and in fact, forcing those board members who were on Pacifica, who were the most egregious, to finally leave the board.
Well, let's step back. You said that there was a takeover of the National Pacifica Board by people who were more interested in a corporate interest or corporatizing of the station airwaves. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the history of WBAI and Pacifica before that time. What was the focus that was being taken away when these folks took over the National Board?
Well, the focus had been on trying to get information out to people about, information that really made its way into the mainstream. We would talk a lot about community issues. We would talk a lot about different government policies that were adversely affecting people, you know, like surveillance. And talk about the Black Panther Party. We would talk about how they were victims of the counterintelligence program. There were people on the board that, at that time, who did not want us to talk about Mumia. They said that, for instance, they didn't want to have breakfast and be listening to people talking about what was happening with Mumia. And they began to try and transform the agency or the foundation into their own image. We have gotten a variety of different awards. All of the stations had pretty much, especially WBAI, we generally led in getting awards for community broadcasting. One of the things that we had that was very important was a program director named Samori Markman, who recognized that one of the ways that we could really begin to build up the station was to begin to bring in have the station more reflect the diversity that was a part of our community. And as a result, he started bringing in more Asians, more African Americans, and more Latinos. And the station began to prosper. We had our first million-dollar fund drive under Samori Marksman's leadership. And I think that kind of angered people, too, both internally at the station as well as in the national office, where they began to feel that they were losing the station and that it was becoming more of a station of people of color, and many people didn't like that.
Well, I think that's an important point that you make when you talk about broadcasting the voice of the voiceless. That's often seen as not something that can gain membership money, that can support a station. But you're saying that in bringing in minority voices, you actually were more successful in your fundraising?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what's missing now. That's why Pacifica is in so much trouble, because they have abandoned that, and they've eliminated a lot of African Americans and Latinos from leadership at the station, as well as from being on the airwaves. And as a result, there are many people who had turned into Pacifica stations and felt that they were very important are now beginning to feel that they're less and less relevant to their lives. So they're not giving any money. They're not listening. They're not tuning into the station. And as a result, when they have their fund drives, they have a smaller reservoir of people from which to draw to get funds. So they're finding it very difficult to get the needed revenue. In addition to that, when we moved to Wall Street at WBAI, the address sounds very good, but what happened was that we were not able to pay the expenses that a Wall Street address required, because we were there and at a discounted rent, but after 5 years it went to market value and we were no longer able it was very difficult to meet that. And when they started eliminating Blacks and Latinos and Asians, it became even more difficult. The last fund drive was, I think they only got 45% of their goal. It came up short over $350,000.
Now, wait, you're talking about now? Or 10 years
ago? I'm talking about right now.
Okay, well, let's go back to the 1999 and 2000. And I wonder if you could talk about Amy Goodman. I know that she started there at WBAI, and I understand she was one of the people that was shut out during this takeover.
Yeah, she was shut out because one of the things that Amy would do when she got on the air is she would talk about what was going on, and they tried to stop her from doing that, and she continued to the point where they finally wouldn't allow her to do shows on the air. She continued to do programs, but they just weren't aired on WBAI. And eventually at the end of once everything was pretty much resolved and the folks got rehired, she negotiated a deal to to be independent. So she's not really governed by Pacifica. In fact, Pacifica pays her. I think the starting payment was like $250,000 a year to produce the one-hour show. And, the rest is pretty much history. And being independent and being able to make decisions based on radio and not any other consideration, she was able to prosper.
So let's talk about the way that Pacifica is governed. It began with Lou Hill and KPFA and then expanded into these five stations, and they're became a national organization. How was that formed, and what role did that national organization play in that crisis?
Well, Pacifica, the boards had all been, the local station boards had all been advisory boards. And these advisory boards were self-appointed boards, and they began to, people who had other ideas about what media was all about began to gravitate to these boards, and eventually they wound up becoming a majority. And once they became a majority, they began to transform the boards and stop a lot of the activities and behaviors that the local stations were involved with. Lou Hill was a conscientious objector who decided that there should be another way that information should be given out to people, that it shouldn't be based on commercial considerations. So he started KPFA in Berkeley, California, and then they opened up KPFK in Los Angeles, and WBAI in New York, and then Houston came in, and then they got another station in Washington, D.C. So it became a national network. And it has all been one experiment because there was no precedent for what had happened. There was no precedent for, first of all, having a non-commercial radio station or a non-commercial network. These were all independent stations, and as such, they tried to maintain their independence. That was a strength as well as a weakness when you're talking about a national organization, because there was never any national coherence. There was just folks acting independently, addressing their particular concerns in their community, which was its strength. But its weakness was that it just never seemed to have come together. So that's how it came together. I don't know if I'm answering all of your questions. Is there any other part?
And then through the 90s, I understand that there was a growing concern about the national board and mismanagement at a national level.
Well, yes, that's when the board began to change. And one of the things that they began to do is try and take power away from the local radio stations so that they could centralize power in the national board and thereby begin to control the local stations. As I said, WBAI was pretty much forced by the national board to go to Wharf Street. It wasn't the desire of the staff at WBAI. That was a decision that was primarily made by the national board. We had an individual who was the chair of the national board, the executive director, Pat Scott, who was into real estate and pretty much was the chief person to negotiate that move to Wall Street. So most of the power began to gravitate toward the national board, and they began to make decisions that were really contrary to Lou Hill's vision of what listener-sponsored radio should be. For instance, one of the things that they were planning to move on was to make it possible for individuals on the national board to benefit personally, financially, from the sale of any of the radio stations, which made it really an incentive to sell the radio stations for many of the folks on the board, because then, you know, they would be able to realize some kind of profit from selling any of the stations.
Well, and at the time, the claim was made by Mary Frances Berry and others at the national level that they were trying to reach a more diverse and larger audience. And I wonder if you can respond to that what they say they were attempting to do.
Well, they said they were trying to reach a more diverse and larger audience, but as I said, at WBAI, that's in fact what the station manager, the program director, had done. he had begun to reach a more diverse as well as a larger audience by bringing in people who were organically linked to those communities, people who were involved directly in what was happening on the ground in those communities. And as a result of them being there, folks tuned in because now the radio station was speaking directly to them. Stations in the South, once WBAI was sold. See, WBAI is in the middle of the commercial dial on the FM. It's 99.5, and it was worth a lot of money. Most of the stations that are dealing with education are on the far end, on the left-hand end of the dial. And that's a community that we were not in. So they were going to sell WBAI and move us down to that end of the dial by buying a radio station there. One of the problems is that in New York City, there are no radio stations that are available. So her claim that they were going to, you know, you always want to get a more diverse audience. You always want to get a larger audience. But I think they were ignoring what was happening at WBAI at that time.
Well, and at first, programmers and volunteers who claimed that those elements in the national board wanted to sell off the stations were told that they were just being paranoid, until an email was leaked that was from a real estate broker to the Pacifica National Board Chair, Mary Frances Berry, that actually outlined the details of a possible sale. So I wonder if you can talk about that and how that impacted your struggle.
Absolutely. I mean, that was the missing link. We had been talking about the folks were desirous of doing that. And when this email was sent out to the wrong people and it got into the hands of, you know, many of us began to see that they were, in fact, having these conversations about, and, you know, it was more than conversations. They were really talking to people who had the capability of purchasing these stations. Then what it did was it gave us, in energy, it was had a galvanizing effect, and folks began to come together, recognizing that this was a real threat. It wasn't just an idle threat. It was something real, and that they were, in fact, moving on it.
Well, let's talk about that organizing effort. How is it that you were able to organize and take Pacifica back?
Well, we were lucky because we had Juan Gonzalez, who was a journalist who worked for the New York Daily News. And in their effort to stop the Daily News from taking advantage of the workers, they developed a campaign, an organized, professional approach to developing a campaign that began to identify where the weaknesses were in those who were trying to take over, and he brought that same campaign to the struggle against Pacifica, and so we had a very well organized machine that began to attack the weaknesses in their plan by identifying those individuals in particular who were the ones who were the strongest in pushing into this new direction and targeting them to try and get them to get off of the board. And as a result of that campaign, we were able to remove those individuals who were the most egregious, those who were the ones who were really the engines behind trying to change, transform Pacifica.
Are there any parting words that you want to leave for listeners on what we can learn from the Pacifica crisis?
I think what we can learn is that, you know, the old saying, freedom is a constant struggle. that you can never relax. You got to continue to analyze what's going on and make adjustments where necessary, and that we're losing many of our freedoms. And if we lose Pacifica, we're going to lose our ability to hear about what's going on inside of the country, as well as its domestic policies, as well as its international policies. And that we have to be vigilant. We have to be willing to stand up and fight and to organize to maintain our voice. Otherwise, we're going to lose it. And once we lose it, we're not going to get it back. It's not going to be turned back over to us once we recognize that it's gone. So I'm hoping that people are paying close attention to what's going on, and they become incensed and begin to stand up and demand that these institutions that are supposed to act in their interests do so.
I've been speaking with Bernard White, a long-term programmer and staff member at WBAI, talking about the crisis at Pacifica in 1999 and 2000, and the ongoing struggle to maintain community and community-focused and democratic radio. Thank you so much for being with us, Bernard.
And thank you.
You're listening to a special program, Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, 45 Years of KABU History. Tonight, we're focusing on the crisis that shook the world of community radio in 1999 when the Pacifica Radio Network faced an attempted corporate takeover. When we come back, we'll speak with former KABU board member and current programmer, Per Fagering, who was on the KABU board during the Pacifica crisis. Now we go to local musician David Rovics with his song, Seize the Airwaves.
This is how it started. It's not hard to understand. From coast to coast, they're lying at a CEO's command. From nationalist public radio, CNN and NBC. Big Brother spewing propaganda from the disinformation ministry. They say the economy is booming. We hear the homeless beggars' cries. They say we help poor countries. We see bombs falling from the skies. Reality doesn't exist, they're trying to say. But some of us decided there is another way. Seize the airwaves, seize the time. 'Cause lying to the people is the real crime. When it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word, we will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. Someone got a transmitter, started up a station. Then the idea spread right across the nation. Like the land and water, the air must be free. So let us shout together, the FCC. Seize the airwaves, seize the time. 'Cause lying to the people is the real crime. When it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word, we will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. And we'll do it all together in a grassroots style, tearing down the fences throughout this whole square mile. It's the new town meeting, it's the way the news should be. The rulers call it chaos, we say it's democracy. So when you turn on the radio and you've had it with this shit, from 88 to 107 makes you wanna have a fit. When you listen to the music and it's all the same pop song, start up a pirate station, 'cause that's where you belong. Seize the airwaves, seize the time. 'Cause lying to the people is the real crime. When it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word, we will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. Seize the airwaves, seize the time. Cause lying to the people is the real crime when it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard.
Local musician David Rovix with his song, Seize the Airwaves. I am joined in the studio by Per Feigering, a longtime programmer here at KBOO Community Radio, and also a former board member. And I understand you were on the board at the time of the Pacifica crisis. And I wonder if you can talk about when you remember first hearing about a crisis at Pacifica Radio.
Well, I think it was around 1995. You know, I used to live in San Francisco, but I didn't listen to KPFA very much because I was had a full-time job and a family, and I was going to school and writing a novel and much of the stuff. So, but I first heard about in 95 where KPFA fired Bill Mandel. Now, Bill Mandel was a longtime programmer. He was an expert on the Soviet Union. And he was also one of the few Soviet experts who was not working for the U.S. government. In other words, he was sort of a critical supporter of the Soviet Union. So they fired him, and this kind of got me upset because I remembered back in 1960 in San Francisco, the so-called City Hall uprising. That's when the House Un-American Activities Committee came to San Francisco City Hall, and they packed the hearing room with their supporters, and Bill Mandel was one of the hostile witnesses. I was out in the hallway with a bunch of Berkeley students. I was a cab driver on my day off, and we all got arrested and stuff. But anyway, Bill Mandel was this longtime programmer, and they fired him. So that got me interested. So I started, I was doing stories for the Portland Free Press, which no longer is around. But anyway, I just started calling people and trying to find out what was going on at Pacifica. And it was, that time was sort of a murky situation. And I talked to a lot of different people, some of whom didn't want to talk to me. And it seemed to me that the big problem with Pacifica was that their national board was not elected. It was an appointed board. And I used to, in my articles for the Free Press, I sort of compared it to the College of Cardinals. You know, some person drops off and the rest of the board nominates somebody else. And that way they sort of control things. And so with all these troubles, there was really no people who didn't like what Pacifica was doing. They had really no alternative except to, file lawsuits eventually.
Well, this was the time when Pat Scott was involved in the national level at Pacifica.
Right.
And there was an effort to bring in more mainstream programming, I understand, in the late 90s.
It seemed that way. Yes, it seemed that way. Bill Mandel was certainly not mainstream. Pat Scott was quoted as saying that when she took over KPFA, she lived in Berkeley, I believe. And she said, well, there'll be no more of this hippie bleep blank, you know. At the same time, that's when Lynn Chadwick was promoting her Healthy Stations project. And she actually came here to Portland a few years later when I was on the board, sort of touting this Healthy Stations thing, which had some board members really kind of scared. It was sort of a document where you'd have kind of like mainstream programming, more like NPR. And the cable board is not receptive to it at all.
Well, and Lynn Chadwick was the executive director of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. Mm-hmm. At the time, she recommended new funding guidelines that would tie stations to Arbitron ratings and higher fundraising goals. That then became connected with firing of staff at a number of stations. And I wonder if you recall KPFK, KPFA, WBAI firing their staff.
Oh, well, let's see. KPFA, I know some programmers got fired. Bill Mandel, and there was some woman who did music stuff, and a lot of longtime programmers who sort of could be called hippie types, you know, were let go. And there was no recourse for their, you know, for their supporters.
Amy Goodman as well, WBAI, was pushed out.
She got in a dispute with WBAI, and so she formed her own outfit, and which has been very successful. There's a lot of bad feeling about that, apparently, still. And at BAI, controversy was there. It's it was a controversy at KPFK in L.A., seen the center part of it was had about this African liberation program, which some people thought were, I don't know, over the edge or something like that. And so it's each station seemed to have its own disputes. And one thing about, at least at KPFA in Berkeley, they had the paid volunteers and the unpaid volunteers. And the paid volunteers are these programmers who were on every day. Well, if you're going to be on every day, you sort of have to have a salary. You know, you can't do it if you're working at a full-time job. But they at one time, they were all in the same union, but then the paid people sort of booted the unpaid people out of their union.
Well, and at that time, KPFA had hired an organization called American Consulting Group, which mm-hmm. was known as a union-busting organization, mm-hmm. Which worked to eliminate the right to strike and to eliminate the unpaid staff from the station's mm-hmm. union.
Well, that had an effect up here because later on, in the later 90s, I was on the board then, and we were not very happy with Pacifica News. We didn't think it was a good program, and plus all the other stuff going on there. And so then we found out that Pacifica was hiring this law firm or whatever, and I remember Gene Lawhorn was on the board here. He got a copy of their promotional video and played it, you know, and people saw that. And so we really decided, you know, Pacifica Radio's got to go. And what happened was that in the meantime, our then station manager signed a contract with Pacifica for 3 years without telling us. So we had to stay with him for 3 more years. Oh, I suppose he could have fought in court, but it seemed like not worth the trouble. And we used those 3 years to line up other news sources. And so I remember when we did that, you know, when we did dump Pacifica, we had a whole lot of other resources to go to.
And that was in 1999?
So around then, yes, I believe it was, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so that's really when KBOO's local news began to form and become a daily.
Lise Kowalczyk was sort of responsible for that. She sort of lined up. She and Grace Marion and Cherie Blackfeather, they really worked on lining up these other sources. And I think Denise was our news director at that time. And so when we did drop Pacifica, we were all set to go. And, you know, that's when the KBOO news staff really began operating, I think. Mm-hmm.
And was KBOO connected to Pacifica at that time in any other way outside of taking that news feed?
Well, I think we're an affiliate, which is kind of you're connected with Pacifica, but you're not part of their network. You know, there's 5 stations in their network, and then they have all these affiliates. And I believe now the affiliates actually vote on a board, on one person on the board. Of course, at that time, you didn't have board elections at all.
So this crisis at Pacifica came to a head in 1999. You talked about the unelected board. Is that when the Pacifica Network began to elect their national board?
Well, there were. It seems to me there were 2 or 3 lawsuits that were filed, and one of them was filed by an attorney named the Gregory Wonderwheel, lives in Santa Rosa, California, I believe. And his wife, her name is Carol. I'm spacing out on her last name, but they filed this lawsuit. It went to some kind of, they reached a settlement. I don't believe it was ever went to court, but there was a settlement where Pacifica would have board elections. So they did. So when that happened, a lot of new people came in. But some of the problems going on now, they almost replicate some of the old stuff. You know, you have this perennial thing. Should an alternative station become more main? How mainstream should we be? You know, you obviously have to, you know, you have to appeal to people other than just a small group of, you know, left wingers. But, you know, what do you have to do to get there? You know, it seems to me you can have debates. You can be hard hitting without, you know, just preaching to the choir. So it's been my philosophy anyway. But so it's like this is still going on in some ways, even though you do have an elected board. And at KPFA, I think they have sort of the listeners board or something like that. And it seems to change. The divisions are so close that they keep changing every election, you know. And so I'm not sure exactly what the issues are there now. I mean, some people say that Pacifica is losing money and that it gets really convoluted, you know. So many separate issues at each station. But I think the basic thing is that at that time you did have this appointed board and you still have this issue, which seems to be a perennial thing of any progressive organization. How do you deal with the Democratic Party, the mainstream progressive left, you know? How far do you want to go in their direction? You know, we see that right here, you know, like so some people think we should be more like OPB, you know, NPR. I mean, they do a good job at what they do, but what they don't do is what is important, you know.
Well, and going back to what happened in 1999, you said there was a lawsuit filed to open the Pacifica board to elections.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand part of the problem was also that the board held secret meetings and those meetings were not opened to the public. And a strategic plan for Pacifica was one of the products of those secret meetings.
Well, that could be. We'd heard about it. I've never actually seen, well, of course, how do you have minutes of a secret meeting, you know, but there was there was sort of behind the scenes talk about selling one or more of the Pacifica stations. You know, this memo got leaked about that, where the idea was that Pacifica would sell maybe WBAI, which was on the commercial end of the spectrum, and with that money they could buy a whole bunch of smaller stations or do all sorts of wonderful things with it, you know. But that memo leaked. But it had been talked about, obviously talked about, without reaching the public.
Right. And as Bernard White pointed out, losing that frequency in New York City means that there would not be a community radio station in New York because there's no other band open.
That could be. Well, maybe it's analogous to KRAB in Seattle. You know, they sold that station. They got, I don't know how much money they got for it. They bought a smaller station, I think, up in Everett. And I understand it barely reaches the northern edge of Seattle. And the call letters KRAB, I think they belong to some station in the southwest, in New Mexico or someplace. And that whole thing is kind of murky, but it happened. And yeah, I don't know. It's Mary Frances Berry, who is also on the national board. She wanted to, with the money from selling one of the big stations, I think her pet project was having a whole lot of community stations throughout the South, you know, sort of African-American stations, which is sort of like a great idea, but why do you have to sell an existing station to do that, you know?
Well, and I think that brings us to a tension that exists in community radio in general, mm-hmm. which is the tension between those who consider community radio to be a place for for the underdog, for the voice of the voiceless, and mm-hmm. those who consider it more of a public access that everyone should have equal access to it, including the more mainstream voices. What role do you think that tension played?
Well, I wouldn't mind having mainstream voices. I would like to see more debates and discussions. On my own show, I've had a few conservatives. One that comes to mind is a fellow named Michael Scheuer, who was actually the first person to head the CIA's Bin Laden program. And he wrote a biography of Bin Laden. And this guy is a Catholic reactionary, an isolationist. And I was interested in his views because in some ways he was saying that the reason that the Al-Qaeda attacked us is because we are messing around in their territory. And if we weren't over there, they wouldn't be messing with us. And I try to get him to explore that, but it's kind of hard to get him. So, you know, you can talk with conservative people. I don't mind that at all. I think we would have more debates with libertarians. And, you know, they call up our call-in shows, too. I think that's all to the good.
Well, and when you have somebody from your perspective, you're going to ask them tough questions that mm-hmm. say a host who has more mainstream views wouldn't ask.
All right. Yes. That's one of the things that really bugs me. I hear some of these call-in or interviews on NPR, and I think, boy, I wish I had that guy, you know. I'd like to ask him this and that, you know. But you look at NPR, they do. I listen to NPR quite a bit, you know, because they cover the world. They have correspondents everywhere, and they do a pretty good job, but it's a lot of things they don't cover. There's a lot of people you never hear on NPR. When do you hear Noam Chomsky on NPR or Michael Parenti or once in a while you hear Chris Hedges? I used to hear him on NPR, but I mean, there's so many voices that we have quite often who you do not hear on NPR. So I think that's a big thing right there.
Well, and do you think that there is a value to having a national network of community radio stations like Pacifica?
I don't know. Pacifica's their whole setup seems really very unwieldy. You know, they got five stations. They've got a national board. That means you have to have national board elections. Apparently, from what I hear, this national office takes up quite a bit of their budget. I think I heard they take something like 20% from every station. I'm not absolutely sure about that, but they do take money for every station to run their own operation. I don't know if that's such a great idea. I think if you had a network of community stations, maybe it should be like a big, huge potluck, you know, where different stations do stories and then make them available to other stations or do interviews. You know, there's a lot of stuff that we do here that we could, that stations all around the country might be interested in. You know, it's not all about local stuff. You know, we can do global issues just as well as anybody else can.
Well, one of the things that came out of the Pacifica crisis, the shutting out of reporters from the stations, was the formation of Free Speech Radio News, mm-hmm. which is an international network of reporters. And I wonder if you think that's something that is of value that came out of that crisis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, I hear it. I listen to it. You know, there's always room for improvement, but it's just great that they are operating.
And without a national board.
Right. Is that run by Catherine Comp?
Well,
and she used to be here at one time.
That's right. Catherine is one of the editors. So mm-hmm. there are several editors mm-hmm. And producers in different places in the country mm-hmm. that put that together. So it's a diffused network. It's not in one single location.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes a lot of sense, you know, where different stations can borrow from each other and I'd like to see more debate and discussion with all sorts of people, you know, here in Portland. You know, there's lots of issues that we can, you know, we can debate about. There's even issues that the left is in disagreement with itself about, you know, that we ought to discuss these things.
So one other thing about the Pacifica crisis in 1999, 2000, you said that the KBOO decided to cut ties with Pacifica News and to develop a local news program. And at a certain point, KBOO then rejoined Pacifica, became an affiliate. Do you know what led to that?
Well, probably that Pacifica became more democratic. You know, they did have an elected board. And so they became more democratic, but they still have a lot of problems, and you still have some of the same antagonisms. A lot of the people who opposed the board back then, now they sort of oppose each other for other issues. So it gets really confusing. I kind of lost track in a way. I educated myself back in the 90s, but I lost track a little bit what's going on there now.
Why is it, do you think, that there is so much infighting in the left?
Well, you know, somebody said that one of the things is, you know, say you're a young person, you know, you're in college or something like that, and you want to really kind of, you know, make your effect on the world. Well, if you're a conservative, you have no problem at all, because it's just so many conservative foundations and publications. If you're a young conservative writer, say at Dartmouth or something like that, where this happened, you know, I mean, right away you get money from these big time conservative outfits, and who knows, a few more years you might be on the board at the National Review, you know, having martinis with Bill Buckley or something. But on the left, there isn't so much of that. You know, if you want to, the paying jobs, doing good. You know, you want to do good, but you also want to make a living at it, and that kind of situation is pretty scarce on the left. You know, especially on the sort of the outer left. You know, the inner left is all, you know, there's different foundations and think tanks associated with the Democrats and everything. But so there's just sort of fewer gigs to go around.
It's all about the money.
Well, it's partly that. You know, everybody feels, you know, that they have something to contribute. They want to be, you know, they want to be part of the action, but they want to, be able to do it for a living, you know, even a modest living. So I think that's part of it. And it's just, I don't know. I don't know if the conservatives have as many divisions as the left does or not. You know, they do now and then. I don't know. There seems to be a lot of factionalism on the left, all these various left-wing splinter parties, and they split, you know, and they get smaller. I don't know. I mean, it seems endemic, you know.
Well, do you think that there is a chance for a Democratic movement or a people's movement, a grassroots people's movement in community radio nationwide?
I think so. I mean, I just heard something on the news today that the FCC is opening up a whole lot of, making room for a whole lot of community radio stations. And so, you know, low power stations, you know, that sort of exist in one little town someplace. Of course, I imagine a lot of them will be taken up by church groups and things like that, but you know, it opens up the airwaves to a lot of people. You know, like in on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, they have their own radio station, KILI. You know, and so it's like, I don't know. I just think the more voices you have, the better it is.
Well, that's a good note to leave it on. Again, I've been speaking with Per Fagering, who is a long-term programmer at KBOO. And was a board member in the 1999 and 2000 crisis at Pacifica. And he talked to us about how KBOO responded at that time and the ongoing issues with community radio.
Well, I hope they resolve it, because Pacifica is a valuable resource. I would hate to see them just kind of go down the tubes because of, oh, I don't know, whatever's going on there.
Well, thank you so much, Per.
Sure, you bet.
This hour, we've been looking at an historical moment in KBOO community radio history, the Pacifica Network Crisis of 1999. The crisis shook Pacifica to the core and was the biggest challenge faced by the network since its founding. This is part of a year-long series on KBOO. Tune in, turn on, and remember, 45 years of KBOO history. Next month, on July 23rd, we'll hear about the setup of KABU's first transmitter in 1968. Be sure to tune in, 6 p.m. on July 23rd. For KABU Community Radio, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
What we're going to do is throw a lot of banana peels around Chicago and have the machine stumble.
I had a dream that the only reason the employers were so powerful was that we were weak.
There's this myth that black people did not resist until Watts or until the Black Panther Party. It's just not true.
The Oglala Nation is at a crossroads that can change the course of history for Indian people all across the nation.
The other half of the women's liberation movement is the boys. And that man who is strong enough to be general, that is a new man.
The Stonewall Bar to me is a terrible place where something great happened.
For 45 years, KABU has let the sun shine in across Cascadia's airwaves. Join us every month in this, our 45th year, as we tell another story from the history of KABU.
Good in the Hood returns to celebrate its 20th year, June 20th through the 30th. Good in the Hood is a multicultural music and food festival featuring a parade, information village, kids space, arts and crafts, and an ethnic marketplace. Saturday, June 29th, Good in the Hood will be at Lilis Albina Park in North Portland with music, and KABU will broadcast live from the park from 2 to 7 p.m. More information about this KABU-sponsored event may be found at KABU.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Have you heard about the Melting Pot Silent Mobile Dance Parties?
Silent Dance.